Oh, jumped right in and told me a recording was in progress. Now I got to behave myself. Like I said, I'm Dan. I am an alcoholic. I certainly qualify to sit in this seat. And I was thinking a little while ago, wow, I met the requirements to be an old timer. I didn't drink and I didn't die. Here I sit with you folks, and it's a pleasure to be here. I've been speaking. I've told my story so many times. I could do it half asleep, which I'm not quite there now, but I am awake. So I always think, geez, I ought to do something different. I ought to say something different. But my drunkalogue has stayed the same all these years, which is a good thing. That means I haven't picked up a drink, and I haven't gone off the deep end with my alcoholism and caused havoc wherever I've been. But you know, I come from a good home. I come from a working class family in Salem, Massachusetts. I was number five of six boys. It could be kind of a crazy house at times, but it was a good place to grow up. It was a nice neighborhood, plenty of kids around to play outside. I gotta take a breath and slow down. I get ahead of myself sometimes. But you know, I came from a good place, and it was alcoholism wasn't something that we had to concern ourselves with a great deal in the beginning. I had some uncles that were, I come to know now, they were alcoholics. We just called them drunks back then. But, you know, they were alcoholics. And one of them actually got sober in about 1946 or 1947 in what is known as the Old Salem Group in Salem, Massachusetts. The group has been around for 75 years or something. And he got sober for a couple of years, but he couldn't hold on to it. And when I sobered up in 1970, 71, I took Uncle Ed to a couple of meetings. I tried to help him, but he wasn't, you know, by then he wasn't really interested anymore. So, I mean, like I've said many times in my, when I've been talking, you know, if you shake my family tree, a whole bunch of empty bottles will fall out of it, because there was drinking going on. In my own house of origin, like I said, I had older brothers. A couple of them were kind of crazy, much like I became as my drinking progressed. But geez, I remember one of my older brothers, 5 years older than me. I'd be laying in bed some nights, and he'd come straggling up the stairs. He'd be covered in blood, and his clothes would be ripped. And I say to myself, "Wow, he must have had a good time tonight. He was out getting into barroom fights, you know." And that's the kind of mindset I had towards drinking. Anyhow, on my 18th birthday, I went off to active duty in the U.S. Navy, and you know, it was, I had started drinking probably a year or two before that. Nothing much, really. It was, you know, it was down the park with the kids, whatever booze we could get people to buy for us. It was usually beer. We did have one place in the neighborhood where we discovered it was a beer distributor had stock some beer in the cellar of one of these factory buildings. And one of the guys discovered that he could push the window into the cellar, and he could get in. He was small enough, he could climb through the window, and he could pass a couple of cases of beer out. And we'd take that down the park and hide it. And that'll be our drink for a few days. But you know, that was kind of, that to me was fun stuff. I went off into the Navy. I didn't want to go. I joined the Navy Reserves when I was in high school, and I volunteered to go on active duty. And I tried to get out of I Yeah, I think I got it now. Sorry about that. I was coughing and I didn't want to blast your eardrums out. Anyhow, I volunteered to go on active duty, and I decided after I did that that I didn't want to go. I went back up to the Salem High School and I tried to enroll in a postgraduate course to further my education, which, believe me, my education had not been very good to begin with. I sat in front of the principal of the school, and I pleaded my case to him how if I could come back into the school, I wouldn't have to go on active duty. I could postpone it for a while. And he listened to my story. He went out and he got my record from the file cabinet, and he brought it in. He sat down for a moment or two and he looked through it, and he picked it up and he put it out on the right-hand corner. I can remember. I can see him doing it to this day. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Mr. Geary, you can go in the Navy, you can go anywhere you want, but you are definitely not coming back into my school." So that's kind of what my reputation was in school. So off I went into the service. I did my 2 years active duty. I saved most of my heavier drinking for when I got home on weekends. There I had older brothers who could take care of me, keep me out of trouble. Make sure I got home, et cetera, et cetera. The things that young drunks do, I got into those. Got through the 2 years of active duty, come home, worked a little job over the holidays that first year that I was home. Did not get kept on after the holidays because me and a couple other guys discovered if we ran on our lunch hour, we could get to the cocktail lounge that was in the mall and fire down some drinks. And we'd get back to work, not in the best shape. And they decided they didn't need us after the holiday season was over and we were let go. I then collected unemployment for the next 9 months, and that was a good deal for me. I was living at home with my parents. Didn't have to pay them any room or board. It was, I probably got $36, $37 every other week. And for a guy 20 years old living at home, and I'm talking probably somewhere near 60 years ago, that was a fair amount of money, and I could do a fair amount of drinking on that money, and that's mainly what it was for. I did buy a little motor scooter, a Vespa motor scooter during this period of time, and I would drive around my neighborhoods, the North Shore of Massachusetts, Salem, Danvers, Lynn, Peabody, wherever, in various stages of drunkenness. And it's a wonder I never got killed, but I made it through. Obviously, I sit here this morning telling you these stories, but I didn't know that I was an alcoholic, and I do believe at that time that I was. My alcoholism was progressing. See, I didn't know about alcoholism. I didn't know it was a progressive illness. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, quite frankly, and it was. But my drinking was progressing, and I was spending more and more time on alcohol than I was other things. During that period of time, I met a young woman. I fell instantly in love with her. It was certainly love at first sight. I fell head over heels with her. We started dating after I got up enough courage to ask a mutual friend if she would go out with me. She said yes. We started dating. That first summer that we were together, we had a lot of fun. It was good. But I found out later on at the end of that summer, her mother suggested that she call it the end of a summer romance and move on from me. But she didn't do that. And I'm forever grateful she didn't. But we think that her mother could see in me what she could see in her father, my wife's now wife's grandfather. He was an alcoholic. We don't know if he ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but Elaine seems to recall maybe seeing a big book on his desk at his apartment, but we don't know about that. If he did, he didn't have much long-term sobriety. But anyway, we think that my to-become mother-in-law was trying to save her daughter from the agony of being married to an alcoholic. Anyhow, we continued on our dating. Just to let you know where my alcoholism was at this point, I had to ask her three times to marry me because the first two times she wouldn't answer. She said that she wouldn't answer if I had been drinking. And of course, I had to drink in order to gather up enough courage to ask her to marry me. You know, that was it. So the third time, I like to think that I must have balanced it just right. Excuse me. Enough alcohol for the courage I needed, but not enough so that I appeared to be drunk. So, and when I was able to do that, she did indeed say yes, and we got engaged. We got married about a year, a year and a half after that, and we started our lives together. And as I said, my alcoholism was progressing. I remember when we were first married, saying to Elaine that, you know, I had been going out on Friday nights with my brothers, and I would like to continue doing that. She said, "Okay, that's fine. You can do that." Well, of course, what happened was it started out Friday nights, then it became Friday and Saturday nights, and then it became Sunday mornings, and then Thursday nights. And as my alcoholism progressed, you know, my out of the house time increased, you know, because I was a barroom drinker. I didn't drink much at home. I like to say that when we were in my early drinking, one of my goals was to have a well-stocked bar in my apartment. And every time I would buy a jug of booze, I would drink it, and I could hardly ever get to have two jugs of booze in the house because I would finish them off before I could buy a second one. These were all signposts to my alcoholism, the way it was going, and it was difficult, believe me. Our first few years of marriage were not wonderful. They were good in many ways, but when my drinking would get going, it was just craziness. And it was during this period of time in early our early marriage, I took a civil service test. I passed it. I got appointed to the fire department in Salem, Massachusetts. And I eventually got appointed to that job. Some of the things I like to remember about that is one particular time when I was on the fire department, I got to work. I had been drinking all day before I went to work on the night shift. I got to work and I slipped into a blackout, and I performed my job, and it was not a Well, we didn't have any big fires, but we had three separate alarms, minor things. And I responded, I did my job. Otherwise, I would have been in trouble. But, you know, I don't remember. I was in a blackout. I don't remember anything of that night. When I woke up, when I got out of bed the next morning and went down, and the guys were talking about the evening before, and I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. So I went down and I checked the logbook, and sure enough, we had responded to three separate alarms. I'll never have any memory of what they were. Minor they were, but they're gone. I'll never know what it was. Now, I could have got fired from that job for any reason during the first year. You're a probationary firefighter. You know, I was risking my job, my career in the fire department, which I probably never should have got in the first place, because some couple of months before I got appointed, the place where I was working was a factory in Salem, and they had quarterly parties for employees only, and they were big drunks. That's all it was. And I had gone to this party, and I was drunk, got drunker, and I was being a real jerk. I was out on the dance floor throwing my elbows around, whacking people. It was a just a not a good sight, and I ended up being arrested that night for assault and battery on a police officer, destruction of public property, inciting a riot, several other things. And one of the charges, which will, if you understand this, will let you know how long ago it was, because drunken disorderly was still considered a crime in Massachusetts that long ago. Since then, it's obviously, you know, alcoholism now is considered, and I believe it is a disease, and it's treated as such most of the time. But anyway, the chief never heard about that episode. if he did, I probably would not have got appointed to the job, because it you know, I was trouble. I was trouble a brewing. Anyway, I got the job. My drinking was progressing rapidly. I was spending, by this time, we had had a son. Towards the end of my drinking, when he was 2 years old, you know, it was my great goal to spend time with my son and be a father and be a good father, you know. And, you know, like I said, I come from a home where I learned from my father what it was to be a good father, a good husband, a good employee, a good citizen. And those were all goals and aspirations that I had. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. Alcoholism was in my way, and I just couldn't be what I wanted to be. And it was slowly but surely gutting me. And, you know, I was becoming what I didn't want to be. And it was painful, but I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand it was the alcohol. I thought the alcohol was my friend. It made me feel good. It made me more sociable. It made me think I was better in many ways. That's the lie that alcohol told me in my own voice, in my own head. But we were having financial difficulties. You know, I was drinking up, you know, even though I was working on the fire department and working part-time jobs, you know, I was drinking a lot of my money up, and it was not good. And we were having financial difficulties. Elaine went back to work at a retail store where she had worked before we got married, and she started working again. And on, like I said, she was working at a retail store, and they would have their holiday party on a Sunday, because back then the stores were closed on Sundays. And that meant that the employees could be ready to go out to enjoy themselves on a Sunday night. And we were scheduled to go to this holiday party. Excuse me. And I had been to her parties before, and I hadn't been the nicest guy in the place. And I made a commitment to myself that I was going to be a good guy. We were going to go to this party. We were going to have a good time. That day, I was going to spend time with our two-year-old son and with Elaine. We would have a nice family day. Everything would be wonderful. Now, I got home from overnight shift Saturday night into Sunday morning. And I was going out to watch a football game. That's American football, not soccer. And it was a cold, snowy December morning. And I took along with me what I had left of a pint of whiskey and a couple of cans of beer, because that was my antifreeze. You know, that would keep me warm, or at least I wouldn't care if I was cold or not. I was drunk before that game was over. I spent the balance of the afternoon drinking in a local club in downtown Salem, finishing off the job. I did remember that I was going to be taking Elaine out to a party that night. When I got home, she decided she really didn't want to go. I was drunk. She didn't want to go anywhere with me when I was drunk, but I insisted that we had to go, because it was important that I show her a good time. I still had that thought in my head. And we were also invited to and scheduled to go to a before party, cocktail party at my in-law's house. My mother-in-law worked at the same store. So we went off to the cocktail party, not before I took my son's piggy bank out on the kitchen floor of the apartment where we were living, and I put a hammer to it, and I smashed the head off and dumped the coins out. We were going to a country club. It was called the Nahant Country Club, and I had never been there, but when I thought country club, I thought expensive, and I didn't have a lot of money. So I took quarters and dimes out of my son's piggy bank so that I'd have enough money to drink. That's where my alcoholism had taken me. Off we went to my in-law's house, and it was a bad scene. I ended up it was my wife and I, my mother and father-in-law, and another couple. And the woman of that couple, somehow the knowledge, I got the knowledge that she was a recent divorcee. So that made her a fair game for me because I consider myself a smooth-talking, debonair drunk. I didn't say drunk at the time, but smooth-talking, debonair, that's for sure. So I tried to put a move on this lady, and sitting there in my in-law's living room on my in-law's couch with my mother-in-law sitting on the other side of this lady. Now, if she remembered the words she had said to her daughter several years ago, she would should you know, just leave me behind. She probably sat there saying, why didn't she listen to me? This silly girl, you know, now she's in for it. And, you know, it was not good. But anyway, off to the party we went. Thankfully, my father-in-law was driving us, and off we went. And we went to the Nahant Country Club. And it's a nice place. It's not a fancy, fancy place, but it's nice. And, you know, everything about that night was bad. You know, I hated everything about it. I hated the place. I hated the people I was with. I hated the meal. I hated the band. There wasn't anything about it that I liked. And I come to find out some little bit of time after that, a month or so later, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I actually hated was me at that point in time. I hated what alcohol had become to me because I couldn't do what I wanted to do. See, and I thought that I was crazy because I knew what I wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be just like my father, who I told you was a great guy. And I wanted to be like him. And I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. And it was eating me up inside. And it was hollowing me out. And I didn't know what the heck was going on. I had no idea. And it was just bad. And, I spent most of that evening at the country club, at the bar drinking. And Elaine spent most of her evening wherever I wasn't. She just stayed away from me because I was trying to pick fights with people. It was just a bad scene. And the best thing I did that night, I found a sitting room off the bar, and I can remember it. I don't remember a lot of that day. I remember a lot of it, but some of it was kind of gray outs. But anyway, I found a couch in the sitting room, and there was a fireplace, and the fire was roaring, and it was very warm and nice. And I sat on the couch, and I put my drink down on the floor, and I promptly passed out. Now, you may have noticed I'm a little thin on top. I like to say now that I'm stylishly shaved. Well, I became bald when I was about 23 years old, and I love being follically challenged now, as my granddaughter calls me. But back then, I didn't like it so much. And I went out to buy a hairpiece. I wanted to cover the top of my head. And I went to a woman who was an expert on toupees. And I told her what I wanted. And she said to me, do you really know what you want? I said, yeah, I want a partial hairpiece. I want to cover this part of my head up here. She said, a partial hairpiece is probably about the size of a half dollar. You're looking at about $300 worth of work. And I said, well, thank you very much. I wasn't spending $300 in the mid-1960s for a hairpiece. That was my drinking money, and I wasn't going to spend it on that. No way. So I went up to one of the local department stores, and I found on sale a wig, which was really quite nice. And I seem to recall it cost like $19.99. Not that much, a fair amount at that point in time. But so I bought that. And like I say, it was like the mid-60s, 67, 68, around that time. And I, it was nice. It was a nice wig. It was, the color almost matched that hair that I had left. I hadn't gone white at that point, but almost matched the colors. It was, it had nice bangs down over my forehead. It had nice sideburns. It was really nice. And it would sit there by the power of gravity. You know, sometimes like when a couple of times when I slipped and fell on the ice during the winter, it would fall off. And one particular time I remember I got up and I started walking away and I went, oh, it's cold. And I felt, and it was gone. And my hairpiece my wig was on the ground where I had fallen. So I had to go back, pick it up, put it on. Oh, well. But anyway, it sat there by gravity if I was in an upright position. But when I passed out on the couch at the country club, the wig took a quarter turn on my head. I had sideburns down over my nose, and I was laying on the couch. And when I was drunk and passed out, I made a lot of bad sounds, a lot of bad odors. I was probably stuffed in a suit that was a little bit too small for me. I probably looked like that proverbial 10 pounds of crap in a 5 pound bag. And it was that's the sight that when my wife came to find me to take me home, that's what she saw and heard. And it was not nice. Now they did take me out, wake me up to take me home. I think they didn't want to inflict me on the Nahant Police Department. And off we went home. Now, some months, 6 weeks before that, when I was at work on the fire department, I worked with a fella who was a great guy. And at that point, he was about a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, he said some words one day. The guys were all sitting around the lunch table. They were, talking about this and that. And they were kind of quizzing him why he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said words to the effect that when he took a drink of alcohol, his life became unmanageable and he didn't want to live that way anymore. And that's why he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I was off. I remember I was off at the sink. It was my day to do the dishes, and I was washing the dishes. And I heard that, and I stored it away in my memory bank. Didn't mean a heck of a lot to me, but it was in there. And when they woke me up to take me home after that last drunk, it was I became aware, obviously, that I was in trouble because I did remember enough of that day, of most of that day, to know that I had been a real idiot. And it was time I was in trouble. And I hated being in trouble. I hate being in trouble to this day. I don't get into trouble as much as I used to, but I still can get it with this mouth of mine. I can get into trouble from time to time. But anyway, when I woke up, when I came to, when they woke me up, Jack Murphy, that was the name of the guy that I heard this from, Jack's words came back to me. And I said, ah, I'm going to tell these people, my in-laws and my wife, on the ride home, I told them that I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother-in-law was a sweetheart. She turned around. She was sitting in the front seat. She turned around and looked me in the eye and said, those self-help groups have done a lot of good for a lot of people, and perhaps you should go. And I was trapped by my own mouth. Anyway, it took me better part of a month. I stayed dry during the holiday seasons. I remember going to a New Year's Eve party where I didn't drink. I was what made me do that? One time before, I had tried to stop drinking a few times before, and one time in particular, I had made the firm commitment that I would stop drinking forever. Usually it was, I'm not going to drink for, I won't drink today, whatever, small periods of time. But I said to myself, I will not drink again. I'm done. I must have had a particularly bad bout. And I lasted 2 days. I picked up a drink. I got drunk, obviously. I went into a blackout. I hopped in my car, and I lived in Massachusetts, and I hopped in the car. Now, I was married. We didn't have our boy yet, but I hopped in the car and I was leaving my wife to go to California. No idea why, it just seemed like a good idea at the time. And I remember driving, going, I went into a blackout, gray out. I drove along. If you, most of you probably don't know the route, but I drove along. I believe it was the Mass Turnpike, it must have been newly opened. And I remember getting on the highway. I don't remember getting off of it. I came to the neck early the next morning, in a parking lot of some place outside of Hartford, Connecticut. And I came to, and it was like, holy crap, what am I doing? I had sobered up enough while I was asleep that I didn't know what the heck was. I knew what I was doing, but I didn't know why. And it's probably a good thing that I didn't have a bottle of booze with me, because if I'd have picked up another drink, I probably would have kept on going west. But as it was, I called home. Elaine had not gone off to work yet. I explained where I was. I remember she said to me something like, "Come home, you damn fool, and go to bed." And I drove home. It was like a 2 hour drive back home. And, you know, it was terrible. So anyway, this time when I quit drinking forever, once I got by 2 days without drinking, and it became 3 days and 4 days and five and a week and so forth, I became increasingly fearful what would happen to me if I picked up a drink. I had that memory of what happened to me the time before that I quit forever and started drinking. I didn't know what would happen if I picked up a drink. I was fearful that I would die, and that certainly could have happened. But it still wasn't straight in my head, because I didn't know about alcoholism. All I knew was I was fearful if I took a drink, I would get into worse trouble and I could die. And I finally, after the better part of a month, I went to the only other guy that I knew was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked with him in the factory where I worked before the fire department. And I went back and I was talking to him. His name was Billy. And I was talking to Billy, explaining to him about what was going on in my life at that point in time. And it was a story of an alcoholic is what it was. And Billy recognized my plea for help for what it was. And he extended the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I was cleared up enough, cleared up enough that I grabbed onto that hand. And he offered to take me to a meeting that night. And I accepted. And he and his sponsor came to pick me up at the apartment where we were living. And Billy's sponsor, his name was Roger. Roger and Billy are dead now also. And Roger LaBeouf was his name. And he tried to explain to me some of the things that may go on at the meeting. He said things to me like, try to identify with what they're talking about. Try not to compare what you may or may not have done with what they may or may not have done. If you're nervous, if you have to sit on your hands, do it. You know, just try to listen as best you can. And most of all, he said to me, take a long time to decide whether you are an alcoholic or not, because it might be the most important decision you'll ever make in your life. And I believe to this day that it was the most important decision I made, at least in that point. You know, probably marrying my wife was probably the most important, but secondly, and maybe not even, maybe tie for first, was the decision that, yeah, I am an alcoholic. And, I sat during that meeting and I listened to people, and they were talking about things that I knew about. They were talking about guilt, shame, remorse, self-loathing, fear, doubt, insecurity, just the things, that big bag of crap that I carried on my shoulder when I came to AA. I knew what they were talking about. I didn't know how they knew what I was thinking. That was the key. See, I didn't know. I was just like all of us, most all of us. I shouldn't say all, but most all of us get to AA carrying that bag of crap that I just described to you. And I did not know that. I thought I was unique. I didn't know other people were like me, and I learned that. After the meeting, I talked with another guy, Doc Wenzel. He was a great guy. He was sober probably 20 years at that time. We talked for a bit, and Doc said to me, "Dan, if you understand what we were talking about tonight, you probably ought to keep coming back." And I did. I started coming back on a very regular basis. As I said, I worked in the firehouse. We worked a couple of days and a couple of nights a week. And on the nights that I wasn't in the firehouse, you could generally find me at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. There weren't a lot of daytime meetings back then. They were just starting to come along. Weekends, there were daytime meetings. My first meeting that I belonged to was one called the St. Richard's Group. It met at St. Richard's Church, and therefore it got that name. But anyway, excuse me. The people that took me to my first bunch of meetings, that's the group they belong to. So I joined that group. Then I started going to on a Sunday morning meeting to, it's called the Witch City group. It's now like 64 years old or 66 years old. It's a very old, very strong meeting. It's been going on, as I said, a long, long time. I joined that. And then, I went to a lot of meetings, and Billy Lovett, for the first few weeks, a month, picked me up regularly to take me to the meetings he was going to. And that's where I learned where the meetings were. And at one point, I can recall saying to him, "Where are we going tomorrow night, Bill?" And he said, "Well, I'm not going to be able to get to a meeting tomorrow night, so, but you can go. It's fine." And so I went to the regular meeting that we would have gone to on whatever night that was. And lo and behold, Billy showed up at the meeting. So what's this all about? It was kind of a test he put me to see if I would get to the meetings on my own with him not dragging me there. And it showed him that I was serious about this, and it was a good thing. And I started going to the meetings on my own, and I became very active in that St. Richard's group. I got to do all the jobs that a newcomer come. Many of you may have heard of the ABCs of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what that is ashtrays, brooms, and coffee cups. And a new person back then was assigned the job to empty the ashtrays, pick up the coffee cups, put the chairs away, set them up when you got there, put them away when you got. These are ways that slowly got me to be part of the group. I graduated from the ABCs and I became assistant coffee maker. And then I became the coffee maker. And then I became the secretary. And I became, at one point later on, in that first year or a year and a half of my sobriety, I became the institution secretary. And what that entailed was getting people, the group committed to put on to take an AA meeting into various institutions, jails, the local insane asylum, Danvers State Hospital, wherever where people couldn't get out to go to meetings, we would take meetings into them. And that was a really good job for me because I ended up, as happens many times, whoever is the chair of those kind of meetings gets to do a lot of the work because getting people to go on those commitments wasn't the easiest thing. And I would go once a month, sometimes twice a month, if we had different institutions to go to. And I would go to these meetings, and particularly the jails. The things I did when I was drinking, I could have ended up in a lot of trouble. I drove drunk all the time. I got into barroom scraps. I remember one particular time I was meeting up with one of my older brothers and a friend of his at a barroom in Salem. And, they had been drinking for a few hours before I got there. And I tried to play catch up and I started drinking shots of whiskey with beers. And I not only caught up to them, I went past them, and I decided it would be a wonderful idea. We were sitting in a booth, and I decided it would be a good idea to try to pick up that booth and throw it over the bar. I have no idea why. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. And I mentioned it to my brother. He said, "You're crazy. We're not going to do that." I said, "Look, Dick, if you don't help me, I'm going to do it myself." And he said, "Go ahead." He didn't think I'd be able to pick it up, let alone throw it over the bar. Well, I did. I picked it up. I carried it over to the bar and I threw it over the bar. I smashed a few bottles of booze on the back shelf. Yeah, that's insanity. I should have got arrested and charged with all kinds of things. And I told you, the last time that I was at a party with my former work, the problems I got into, these things were. That was a lot of the stuff I did. And, when I was doing the meetings at the jails, and when I would leave the jail and the doors would close behind me and I would be on the outside, I got a real sense of relief and gratitude for the fact that I wasn't drinking anymore, because I would have ended up in a place like that for sure. Like I said, I told you I thought I was crazy because I couldn't be what I wanted to be when I was drinking, and that would have I would have ended up in the nut house for sure. Anyway, I was learning a lot. I learned things like alcoholism is a disease. It's threefold. It's physical, it's mental, and spiritual. And I learned that the physical part of the disease, when I learned this, it really gave me great relief, because it gave me some understanding of why I did what I did, the reason I drank the way I did. I learned that when I put a drink of alcohol into my body, the way my body is so constructed, that drink of alcohol set off a physical compulsion, which would require me to drink more. Now, believe me, I was a willing participant. Nobody had to hold me down and pour a drink down my throat. I drank. Now, I thought I drank because I wanted to, and I learned that I drank because I had to once I put a drink of booze in me. The physical compulsion was coupled with a mental obsession. No matter what kind of problem I could get into, no matter what kind of promise I could make and not keep, I could always say, well, next time it'll be different. Next time it'll be better. Next time I won't drink with those people. Next time I won't drink that kind of drink. Next time I won't drink at that particular bar room. Always it would be different, but I would be able to drink. See, I didn't know that that wasn't going to happen. You know, the physical compulsion coupled with the mental obsession led me to take those values that I mentioned to you, that I learned in the home of my origin, that I learned in school, that I learned, I went to church back then. The things that I learned in church, I'm sure I picked up, you know, some pretty good moral teachings along the way. Those values that I had with the physical compulsion, mental obsession coupled together, it caused me to take those values and little by little set them aside and say, well, I would do whatever I had to do to get the next drink of alcohol. And that was where I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a sad place. But as I became, as my alcoholism, as my learning about alcoholism and my ability to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me to grow. And I've worked at 12 steps to the best of my ability during the time I've been here. I've done a lot of things. I've spoken at a lot of meetings. I tried to help people as much as I could. I learned that most of my 12-step work has been this kind of thing, sharing at meetings. I do share one-on-one with people. I never was a great sponsor. I'm not, you know, I don't want people calling me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I want to be sleeping at that time. You know, that might be a little selfish on my part, but oh well. You know, it's okay. I help people when they ask me to. I've got a couple of people that I'm a sponsor for now, and it's more like we're friends. You know, we talk a little. We talk. You know, they run things by me once in a while, but mainly, you know, it's, you know, I had a sponsor for years and years and years, and his name was Jack Delaney. Jack was a great guy. Jack's been dead about 7 or 8 years now. And he used to say to me, when I would say to people, Jack's my sponsor, he would say, Dan's more my sponsor. And what we were good friends. And we just talked to each other a lot about a lot of different things, about alcoholism, about the problems we were having, about the joys we were having, about life in general. That was the kind of relationship we had. And that's the kind of relationship I try to have with people I try to help. More of a friendship. I've never taken anybody through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody ever took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not the way that I got sober in AA. I did the 12 steps on my own. I did them to the best of my ability. I continue to try to live those 12 steps, again, to the best of my ability. You know, that's all I can do, is anything to the best of my ability. And it was, you know, I've gained a lot in my sobriety. I've gained a life that I never would have had drunk. I would have been dead by now. I'm quite sure of that. I just want to throw this in. Some 20 years ago, something like that, I became increasingly sure that I didn't believe in any kind of God. You know, it just was something I tried to fake it for years. You know, I went back to the church of my youth, the Catholic Church, if you will. It was, you know, I went back with my wife. We became lectors. We read the readings at the masses. I really was trying to make it work for me, and it just didn't. It didn't feel right. It just wasn't for me. And I finally, through talking with another friend of mine who was a sober alcoholic, an atheist, talking to him, learning about atheism, I came to allow myself to understand I'm an atheist, and that's okay. See, I do pretty much the same thing today that I did all the way back to the beginning. I stay sober a day at a time. I don't take the first drink no matter what. I try to stay attached to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I get my strength and my power. I try to help another drunk when I can. And it works for me. Like I say, it's been probably about 20 years since I've become aware that I'm an atheist. And it was freeing for me. I don't feel like a phony anymore. You know, I don't say any prayers. I don't do any of that. Our meetings, our atheist agnostic meetings that I go to, generally we close the meeting with a responsibility declaration. I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. And that's why I try to keep doing what I do. See, that responsibility declaration means a lot to me. My mother's alcoholism took off. I was pretty much out of the house when alcohol took a hold of her. And when booze was done with her, I was about a year and a half sober myself. And she came to me, and I was able to hook her up with some women in the program. And she spent the last 25 years of her life without a drink of alcohol. And that was a gift to my father, to the rest of the family, and to her. You know, she had Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my older brothers, when he was done with booze, he came to me. I got him to a meeting. He didn't take to it right away. But a few months later, he went to a meeting on his own, and he lived his last 44 years or so of his life without drinking alcohol. You know, that was a gift. And now, a little over 6 years ago, our grandson, I have a grandson who's 28 and a granddaughter who's 25. They're in my life. They're a big part of my life. I'm a big part of their life. That wouldn't have happened without Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, my grandson was having his problems with booze. And in fact, he hid it, like much like I did from people. And one day I was in a car. We were heading up to New Hampshire, me and a friend of mine. And I got a phone call from my grandson, who is another Dan. And he said, "Grampy, I'm in trouble. I got to stop drinking. I'm really in a lot of trouble with it." And I said, "Okay, I'll come back home, and we'll go out to a meeting tonight, Dan." And before I could get home, he was in enough pain that he, like kids today, he went online and he found himself a meeting that afternoon at something called the White Whale in Beverly, Massachusetts, where they have meetings all day long, you know, and he went to a meeting on his own. And then I picked him up and we went out to a meeting that night. And last November, a month or so ago, I think it's the 25th or the 26th of November, he celebrated 6 years of continuous sobriety and alcoholics. And I get choked up when I think of that. What a life he's going to have if he can maintain that a day. And he's doing a great job. He's moved a few times. He's gone through a relationship. He's changed jobs. He's moved a few times. He's done it all in sobriety. And he's got a real good foundation. He's now the treasurer of his home group. He lives probably 60 or 70 miles from us now. So I don't see him as often as like, but, you know, we talk fairly regularly. And he actually came last Saturday to one of my meetings, and he presented me with my medallion for my 54th anniversary. And, you know, that was just a wonderful thing. He was there. My wife was there. Our granddaughter came to the meeting, first time since she was a little girl, she came. It was just wonderful to have the grandkids there. I am so fortunate and I feel so grateful that I live in a time where there is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had a chance to get sober, stay sober, and live a life really worth living. I've had some health issues over the, I had triple bypass surgery and aortic valve replacement a little over 2 years ago. I was near death, I know that. I don't know how close to death I was, but I was a very sick man for quite a long while afterwards, and I've come through it pretty well. I don't have the strength that I would like to have. This voice that keeps on frogging up for me. I wasn't like that before, but I was intubated for about, I don't know how long, 7 to 10 days. And I think it did some damage, but I've had it checked and they say, no, you don't have any scar tissue. Who knows? But if that's the worst thing that I'm left with, other than a really nice looking scar on my chest, I'm okay with that. I made it through. I'm eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous and people in rooms such as this. And, I know that there's no time limit, but I've really gone way beyond what I should have. I'm the kind of person who should not be told there's no time limit, because even when there's a time limit, I usually bust right through that and keep going anyway. But look at, I'm really pleased to see you all. Some of you I've seen before. I've come on to SNUA. Before I was on when Mary Susan spoke for her anniversary. I've spoken for my anniversary before. Mark likes to get me on. I've recently become friends on Facebook with Tommy, and Tom's gonna get me. My great grandfather came from Cork City, and Tommy actually found on Ireland's version of Google a picture of the front door of the house on the street where my great grandfather lived when he was a young man. And he sent that to me. So that was kind of neat. And he's promised that someday when he's walking by, he'll take some photos and send them to me. What a great thing that is. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous goes, it's so much more than just staying sober a day at a time. It's life, it's living, it's joy, it's fellowship. It's just a marvelous way to live. So if you're new, or you're just coming back, if you're having problems, hang on to your seat. Do everything you can to keep your ass in the seat at Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's well worth it. Put the work in, you'll be really, really happy you did. Thank you very much for your patience and for listening to me this morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. Take care and have a great sober day.